This podcast of Left, Right, and Center is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support this free service by September 5th and you could win a Mini Cooper S convertible. Go to KCRW.com for details.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's go!
John Roberts, nice Washington lawyer or Manchurian ultra-conservative, plus China's currency move and Iraq's shoddy army. Hello again and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the screaming talking heads that dominate political debate. I'm Matt Miller, columnist for Fortune magazine and senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, holding down the center here on Left, Right, and Center. Joining me on the left side of the political spectrum from San Francisco today is Robert Scheer, a syndicated columnist based at the Los Angeles Times. On the right from Washington, as always, is Tony Blankley, editorial page editor and columnist for the Washington Times. Arianna Huffington is away today. The big news this week, obviously, was the nomination by President Bush of John Roberts to the Supreme Court, making what seemed to be a lovely and well embraced debut in the brief press conference with President Bush at the White House. Already, there's been lots of reaction from all sides. Why don't we hear it on this among ourselves first, and then see where it goes from there? Bob Scheer, are you part of the group that's sending out thousands of alert memos? Are you concerned about what John Roberts means? How are you assessing this nominee?
I'm not terribly excited.
Okay, enough said. and is that because
No, I mean, seriously, Matt. No, let me just explain that. I mean, it's somehow great news if we get a reasonable conservative appointee who seems to have his head screwed on right, who seems to make sense. And then we should be grateful, I suppose. My expectations are extremely low for a Bush appointee. And this guy seems to be okay. So what I'm worried about is this is a feint in the direction of reasonableness, preparing us for some wretched appointment to replace Rehnquist. I don't know. But I think it would be difficult to say this is a horrible thing or something we should all be up in arms about. I don't feel that way.
So what do you make then of the – I want to get Tony in a second, but do you share my feeling that there's just something – when you see the guy, when you know his record and, you know, get some early feel for him, when you see the kind of overnight email blasts and stuff going on from whether it's MoveOn.org or the People for the American Way – you know, trying to raise real questions already, you know, do you find that distasteful, or is that just, you know, this is the way the game is played and the right wing does it when Clinton puts up appointees or what?
Do I find it distasteful that people raise questions of deep concern to them? No, that's their right. And also, you know, it's the right of other people to disagree with them. But we're not talking about some minor appointment. We're talking about a relatively young person who can certainly help shape this court. I find it reassuring, if I can believe the media accounts, that he does believe in judicial restraint and would not do the kinds of aggressive things that Scalia and Thomas have favored. But who knows? You know, we've been fooled before. But certainly the notices on this man would indicate he's not some crazed radical. And so, therefore, one is a bit relieved.
Tony?
I have the suspicion, although I don't know anything special, that liberals may be falling victim to their own cultural stereotyping of conservatives. Because he graduated one at Harvard and he's a member of a major Washington law firm and he doesn't drag his knuckles on the ground and apparently has good manners, they assume he's not really a conservative. I've constantly heard over the last few days, despite the fact that he's conservative, he doesn't do the following things. I think they could be misled. In fact, there are a few conservatives who are well-educated, well-bred, and still very conservative. And I have the hunch that Justice Roberts may be one of those, although it's a little too early to tell. The one thing I think I know pretty well is that regarding the Interstate Commerce Clause, he will be very much in the Rehnquist tradition, not surprisingly given that he was a Rehnquist clerk. But that was the one issue that Rehnquist absolutely insisted on with his clerks, I'm told, that they have a very restrained view of the Interstate Commerce Clause, and that apparently, from what we know, and of course the famous toad phrase in one of his opinions seems to support that, that he will have a more restricted view of interstate commerce, which is probably why the business community feels so comfortable with his nomination.
We should explain for those in our audience who aren't constitutional scholars or even lawyers, and there may be a few non-lawyers left in America, that the although the two out of three on this show are lapsed lawyers of sorts, is that the Interstate Commerce Clause of the Constitution is the vehicle through which the court essentially validated the kind of post-New Deal expansion of federal regulation of all kinds of business activity and other aspects of commercial life, right? And those who are, I guess, the most hopeful on the ideologically conservative side talk about some, quote, constitution in exile that needs to be restored somehow through a more restrictive interpretation of this Commerce Clause that would presumably, if more adherence to that view got on the court, and if it turns out Roberts is, in fact, a holder of that, could over time chip away at some of the federal regulations that a lot of folks, me included, think are important for a modern advanced society in terms of assuring both sort of predictability and equity across the country and also rights and fairness. Is that a fair statement, Tony, of what the—
Limited but fair. it doesn't restrict itself to what we think of as commerce. Two recent opinions, one regarding medical marijuana, which was, I think, in, you know, the court found sort of a substantively conservative, if you will, but procedurally liberal view. They found a federal claim to tell the states how to manage medical marijuana. And, of course, the toad case, which was an endangered species issue, where Justice Roberts himself reported that, or wrote that, a toad that chose for his own purposes to live only in California should not be considered an element of interstate commerce. So it reaches beyond what most people think of as commerce.
Now, are you a Constitution in Exile guy, Tony?
I am. I visit the Constitution regularly. Yeah. I bring small treats to it. It's in the top of a mountain somewhere in Wyoming. I can't tell you exactly where it is because I'm not allowed to.
But are you really one of these? Are you really somebody who believes that we took a wrong turn in the 1930s constitutionally, and that all this should be rolled back?
No, I don't think 1930s. I would say more in the 1950s. I think that most of the rulings of the Roosevelt Court through the 40s. In early 50s were good, and I do not include in that, by the way, Brown v. Board of Education, which I think was an exceptionally important and necessary decision.
Bob, jump in.
Yeah, look, I think the whole thing is being cast incorrectly. This has got nothing to do with being conservative. What has happened is that the conservatives have abandoned restraint. No conservative would have done what was done in the election to overturn Florida and decide state voting issues in that way. This is a caricature of the conservative position. And I think increasingly the Republicans, so-called conservatives Republicans, are associated with big government. When are they going to get off the dime and you know, they keep blasting big government? They are the federal government. They are the big spenders. They're the ones that want to intervene everywhere. And they'll use the federal government to intervene against states that extend individual freedom, whether it be about marijuana, whether it be ultimately about marriages. I'm worried about the federal court. So if by a conservative we mean somebody who believes in restraint and letting states have some power and letting individuals have some power, say on an issue like abortion, let a woman choose, and if that's the way they define being conservative, and they're against torture, which I gather one of his strong points is that at one moment he was against attacking prisoners. Fine, we need that kind of conservative. But I think this division that somehow, you know, there's a judicial activism of liberals who want to use the federal government for all these advanced ways, I think that's a dead issue. The fact is the big defenders of big government right now are the Republicans, and they want the courts to go along with them.
Let me toss in a couple of thoughts, which is, first, I do think that these kind of imaginings of the Constitution in exile conservatives that there can ever be a day when we do things like see a Supreme Court invalidate the ability of the federal government to set a federal minimum wage, I think is really fantasy. And the reason is not because you couldn't come up with doctrinal arguments or judicial arguments to do that, because as someone who himself was trained as a lawyer, you know, what I took away from 3 years of law school is that the Constitution is what five justices of the Supreme Court say it is. I mean, it really is. It comes down to there are very good arguments you can make on both sides of these close cases, and it's a matter of who's got five votes, and that's why these things matter. But at the end of the day, the actual actions of the court, I believe, are totally constrained by the broader consensus in the culture. And you cannot, in the 21st century, you know, 100 years after the cases that established more federal regulation and established minimum standards for workers, the ability of the federal government to do consumer protections and consumer safety issues, the idea that that will be rolled back and be accepted by the public, I think there is zero chance of that. And I think that any court mindful, which these justices always are, of their institutional credibility in anything they do, will ultimately feel constrained by that, no matter what the kind of more radical or aggressive, whatever you want to call it, the sensibilities are of this this movement of justices, even if some of them are on the court or more get on the court. The other thing I would add is that, and Bob, you know, it is always funny to hear, the Democratic side, our side, you know, hailing O'Connor and then also criticizing the radical decision in Bush versus Gore, since O'Connor was a deciding person on that. That's something I think that that can't quite be reconciled. But I do think that the need on the Democratic side to win more of the battles it's trying to do in state legislatures and political legislatures is something that we end up putting so much energy into the debates we'll see this summer on that side, and not enough into trying to organize and push the consensus on things like abortion and the abortion rights, safe, legal, and rare in the broader public. Reaction?
Can I put in a small word for the Constitution in exile? And I don't disagree with you. I completely agree that the court is to a measurable degree a product of the culture in which it functions, and I don't doubt that. The question, and the interesting question, of course, is whether the culture itself is moving in a direction that would induce the court to at least retrench in some areas consistent with a more conservative culture that we clearly have now than we had in the 1950s, 60s, or 70s. And I think there's some potential for a court that was consistent over a 10 or 15-year period, if it had that cultural support, to retrench measurably. But I completely agree with you that it's implausible that a court could simply, on its own intellectual inclination, move against the broader culture.
Bob? You know, first of all, let me affirm the value of states' rights here. I could see a situation. Well, first of all, let me just say flat out, I'd love it as a Californian, a taxpayer, to get all of our federal money back and allocate it on a state level. I mean, the idea that somehow the federal government is the engine of progress has been destroyed by Republican federal governments. I think if we could have state power and have some enlightened sectors like perhaps California, New York, and a few others, we might have some progress. And I think we'd have it on individual liberty issues like marriage and abortion and legalizing marijuana and so forth. I think we'd have it on social issues. So for instance, even take something like the economic issue, Enron. California was overruled. Federally. Take the Schiavo case. Where are the conservatives? They were willing to use the U.S. Congress and try to get the Supreme Court, fortunately the Supreme Court held to its sanity, to prevent the local functioning of courts. I mean, it's amazing to me that they still claim the name conservative. And I think the dirty secret here is that the Republicans will know very well if they end a women's right to choose, if they reverse that basic principle, they will not be elected for another 50 years. They know that. And so what they do is they want to play politics with that issue. They want to play politics with gay marriages. They don't really want victory on those issues at all. They don't want to be held accountable. And in terms of the power of the government, just look at that last decision about the eminent domain. I mean, they want government. government to be able to do all sorts of things if developers want it or if defense contractors want it. They want that power. So let's not give it, you know, I don't know what the Democratic argument is. I personally am tired of defending some kind of overblown image of the federal government, which actually spends most of my tax dollars on programs that I don't like, military contractors and so forth, and I'm somehow supposed to defend that. The New Deal is over. It's settled history. It's not going to be challenged, and the Republicans are in favor of big government spending, big federal government.
Up ahead, China's mighty economy, Iraq's weakling army. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Find more Left, Right, and Center programs and podcasts at kcrw.com.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Matt Miller in the center, but Robert Scheer is in San Francisco on the left, Tony Blankley in Washington on the right. We're going to go to China, but Bob, just because we're not a fact-free zone, the truth is you support most of the spending the federal government does because most of it is Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, military and civil service pensions. That's the bulk. It's growing. So I take your point, but the truth is you support that stuff.
Can I very briefly respond?
I knew that would happen.
Well, come on. Social Security, Medicare, which, by the way, are not programs they're going to be able to attack. That's
I'm just saying
Of course I support it. But the discretionary spending, the money that we can actually have some control over, basically goes to programs that I don't support at this point. Plenty of the domestic spending goes to programs that I don't support. Come on. It's a fantasy. The things that I care about, for instance, welfare spending, which were chopped by people like you in the Clinton administration, and turned back to the basic powers turned back to the states. The welfare state doesn't exist. The amount of money spent federally on education, on programs to help the poor, on programs to help working people and so forth is very minimal. So even though you call it domestic, a lot of it goes to support business. It supports a scientific industry that supports business. It supports agriculture, big agriculture. So don't give me that malarkey that somehow every federal dollar that's not spent on the military is somehow spent for a liberal cause. It's just not true. It's a very small percentage of federal spending, and frankly, I think we could do a better job on the state level at this point.
We'll debate the fuller budget another time. Let's move on to China, where there's big news this week. After lots of pressure, especially from the U.S. and from others in the global community, China has let its currency rise versus the dollar slightly. Sort of a 2%, you know, it had been pegged since 1997 or 1998 firmly to the dollar. There's been lots of jawboning by Democrats and even Republicans in Washington, a kind of chorus saying that China needed to revalue its currency so it would make U.S. goods more attractive there and do something to make a dent in the trade deficits. The early observations coming out just in the press today from a lot of the gurus on all sides, Tony, is that maybe this is a 2% move to make the yuan stronger against the dollar than it has been for years, a kind of political move perhaps, but not something that is going to make much difference economically at this point. How do you interpret what's happened? And talk about it also in the backdrop of CNOOC, the Chinese oil company, bid for the U.S. oil company Unocal, which looks like it's now been topped, and it looks like CNOOC now not – looks like at this point they won't be able to do that takeover. How do you see it all?
Pretty much that way. the actual 2% move is not substantively significant. It's symbolic, and the question is, of what is it symbolic? And I suspect, but I would never begin to claim I know what the mindset of Beijing government is, that it seemed like a politic move in the face of very strong, particularly congressional bipartisan negative reaction to the attempt to buy Unocal, some very extravagant statements had been made by some Red Army generals about nuclear war, which nobody really wants to have repeated, and that this was a move to calm the waters symbolically. Now, if they in fact are planning to genuinely let it float, and some people think, you put me no better than I do, Matt, that looking at a 15 or 20 or 25% adjustment in their currency, that would be substantial and that would have perhaps some impact. Although I've got to say, we just bought, my wife and I, a very fine piece of furniture made in China for $250. I mean, it's just sort of embarrassing. If it had been made in America or Europe, I think we would have paid like $2,000.
Right.
And the finish, if you feel underneath the details, I mean, it was a beautiful little desk. And if it was an American-made desk, it would have been, you know, screws on the outside and splinters when you handle it. So they make an extraordinary product because of their cheap labor. And I'm not convinced that even a 20 or 25% adjustment in the cost would reflect the extraordinary value that people get from buying Chinese products. I hate to say that because I would prefer that everybody bought only American products, which were the best at all times. But the fact is that they have an advantage because of their low wages and the skill of their labor. And I don't think that currency adjustments are likely to be strategically significant.
Bob?
Yeah, I think there's a great deal of hypocrisy on this whole question. I mean, where do we get off saying the Chinese can't buy an oil products company? I mean, my God, the U.S. has bought things all over the world. U.S. companies buy things all over the world. That's our whole principle of capitalism. And what is really annoying to people is these people are playing our game. You know, this anomaly of a ostensibly communist-run country is better at capitalism than right now, certainly any emerging capitalist market, maybe any other. The real story lurking here is whether this means that the Chinese currency is unhinged from the dollar. That's a big story. Because I agree, I don't think the prices are going to change that much. And, you know, China still has to import oil and they have to pay for the steel and so forth that they produce. And labor is not going to be ultimately that big a factor because Chinese wages are going up and their needs increase. But I think the big factor here is whether they will continue to float the American currency, American debt, which is enormous. And if the Chinese say no, they're not going to keep all those dollars. That could, and today Malaysia announced that it's no longer going to connect its currency to the dollar. That could be very serious. And if the euro becomes the standard or so forth, it'll be much more difficult to float the American debt and the enormous balance of payments debt.
Well, it's hard to know how we get out of this dependency on others, especially China. You know, a totalitarian still developing economy on whom we're totally dependent to finance the fact that we want to spend more than we invest and save. And it's not sustainable in the long term. But I don't know anybody who knows how we're going to ease our way out of this. Go ahead.
But keep in mind, at a technical level, the Chinese or anybody who sells products in America for dollars has to buy some dollar-denominated asset. And, of course, traditionally it has been treasury notes. They attempted to buy Unocal, which would be another dollar-denominated asset, and it looked like they're going to be shut out there. So they have a problem, too, that as long as they want to sell in America, they've got to own something that is dollar-denominated, and they can't simply take the dollars and not convert them. So there's a challenge for them. It's not like they can immediately do terrible things to us. If they want to sell here, they've got to own dollar denominated to keep at a sheer technical level the transaction functions.
And they don't have an incentive in divesting out of dollars in some dramatic way that will affect the, you know, if they do that with 5% of their holdings and devalued what the rest of their holdings was, it's a huge self-inflicted wound.
Course.
It's hard to think how to get out of it. Bob, I can hear you itching to
Well, it's just
add economic insight.
You keep talking about being lapsed lawyers. I guess I'm a lapsed economist, as I suppose you are also, Matt. But I mean, the idea that buying
just
oil
lapsed
companies is the same as keeping treasury notes. I mean, they are funding our debt by holding our bad, what is basically bad paper. That's a world of difference from them buying up real assets with those dollars. You know, say buying Texas oil with those dollars. And if they don't get it here, they're going to get it elsewhere. And so separating their currency from ours, which I think was a ridiculous chant of Congress, Democrats and Republicans. I don't know what the senator from New York Schumer is all about here. I think it's lunacy to blast the Chinese for carrying our debt all this time. They may call our bluff now. And if they say, well, forget it, we're not going to float the U.S. dollar and we're going to
take our existing dollars and put into real assets, and we're going to float our connect our currency with other people's currency or a basket of currency, that portends great difficulty for the American economy, much more serious than the competitiveness of that piece of furniture that Tony bought. And I want to say one thing on the furniture thing. The one thing we should ask for in these trade agreements has nothing to do with what the demand about the dollar. It should be that all countries observe laws about not using prison labor, not using child labor, have the right to organize, and yes, keep products out of our country if, in fact, they are made in that way. And that should be built in very strongly into any trade agreements, along with copyright protection and everything else. That is not built in.
But
and that's where the playing field doesn't get leveled.
But the thing that's fascinating that everyone has to keep in mind about the big picture on China, and I've talked to business leaders there and others, is that the what's going on now, this sort of tricky transition to toward capitalism in a communist country, is already in the last 20 years done more to lift more people out of poverty probably than any other time in human history. And there are business people who are, you know, true Democrats, little d Democrats, who believe in, you know, who are Western folks who are over there, who believe in the Western way, who argue that at this point the challenge is so huge to try and navigate, you know, this billion plus iceberg with vast inequalities right now between the coast and all the much poorer inner areas, with huge health issues, with huge, you know, pension and retirement issues, which just huge issues that are, you know, as huge as anything with China is. They think that the best hope is for a kind of benevolent dictatorship that tries to navigate this transition over the next couple of decades in ways that ought to be good for the world if we manage it right. We only got a couple of seconds before we rant, Tony, but let me give you a last word on China.
Well, I would just suggest that we're all impressed with the Chinese economy, but compared to other developing economies, the American industrial economy in the last part of the 19th century, Japanese and German after World War II, the Asian tigers a little bit later, they're developing at growth rates approximately comparable to that. They, you know, when you have nothing, it's easy to move at 7, 8, 9, 10% growth. Once you start electrifying the country, building roads, getting everybody having cars and the rest, then it becomes harder to grow at much above 3.5%. So I'm not quite as intimidated about the out-year prospects of the Chinese economy as many people are. And I am impressed, as you pointed out, with the many challenges they have, not only the fact they don't really have a banking system is largely fraudulent. They have 800 million peasants who are not integrated culturally in the country, and the fact that they're still a dictatorship, and it's hard to imagine a sustained multi-generational private market expanding without trying to get to some kind of a more pluralistic representative government, and they may end up in civil war before they make that transition.
We have reached that time once again for our famed end of show, Left, Right, and Center Rant, featuring pet peeves from across the ideological spectrum. Bob Scheer, let me go to you first, and we didn't get to the Iraq Army, so take it there or anywhere you want.
No, I want to rant on a more personal note, the death of Susan Gordon Lydon, a terrific American journalist. And she wrote for me when I was editing Ramparts magazine. She wrote a pioneering article on the female orgasm, which may seem trivial now, but at that time it was still denied that far into the 60s that women could enjoy sex. And on that subject, many others, Susan was a pioneering journalist, and we're going to miss her.
About 20 seconds, Tony Blankley.
Well, I'll just keep it short and say I've never minimized the importance of the female orgasm.
Let me say on the Supreme Court, I have been torn since law school, really. This is 20 years ago, between viewing the Supreme Court as kind of a pure exercise of power, because it is about where you can get 5 votes for arguments that can be very sophisticated on both sides, but also with this truly more idealistic and, I think, with integrity, a view of legal reasoning as something that's distinct from pure politics. And that tension, which is, I think, at the heart of all these debates we have every time we look at an individual nominee and what their judicial approach is going to be on the court, is something that doesn't get enough discussion or appreciation. So let's appreciate that tension today. That's all the appreciation we have time for today on Left, Right, and Center. Thanks, as always, to my colleagues, Tony Blankley and Robert Scheer. Sarah Spitz produced today's program. Our technical director is Ray Guarna. I'm Matt Miller. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Audio archives and podcasts of KCRW programs are at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about Left, Right, and Center, email lrc@kcrw.com. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by 89.9 KCRW Santa Monica and kcrw.com.